That's what the 80s was all the time. And it's like...
Radio Drone.
Welcome to another Thursday night. I am Josh Hadley. I wonder if you're nostalgic for the early episodes of this show. I'm not. That's not a shot at Brad. I'm not happy with the edits or how unpolished they were. But regardless, I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, is Peter the Gajic the Serbian.
Yes, and I for one am nostalgic for the early episodes of the show. It's pretty entertaining. Not as polished episodes, but I still like to listen to them every now and then, and this was a way for me to get into the show. So I am nostalgic for the early Radiodrome.
Fair enough. And Cecil won't be here because he has nerd flu. See, over the last week he was covering PAX for The Escapist, and he, along with many of the other people, caught nerd flu there. So, and I quote, "I'm overdosing on NyQuil and sleeping the rest of the day."
Oh, no.
So Cecil won't be here this week. He should be back next week, though. We got Glenn from the future because he's coming to us from the UK where it's already tomorrow.
It's certainly tomorrow. It's very, very early tomorrow. I feel like I'm doing a very nostalgic episode for myself, actually. Like my first episode of Radio Drone, which was, again, at about 4 a.m.
Oh, wow.
So if I sound like I'm asleep.
You might
probably
be.
Are.
Well, you know what could wake you up? Well, neither of you could because you're both foreigners, but the Americans could go to adamandeve.com. Get woken up there. Use the promo code DROME, D-R-O-M-E, and you will get 50% off of a single item, 3 free DVDs, a free Power O-ring, and free U.S. shipping. Just use the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. We're going to talk about nostalgia tonight and the dangers that come with nostalgia exploitation. Now, when I say nostalgia exploitation, what do you think of?
I think as far as that goes, maybe something like, and I enjoyed the movie, like by no means am I trashing it, because I enjoyed it for what it was, but I would consider it something like a Terminator Genisys, where that movie is flat out banking on the nostalgia factor for people to enjoy it, because it's straight out recreating scenes from the original Terminator, you know, when the 1984 stuff with the young Arnold and the T-1000 showing up for the sake of it and stuff like that. It feels almost more like a big studio fan film, fan servicey kind of thing for nostalgia's sake rather than a real movie. Even though I enjoyed it, I can kind of see it for what it is. And it's sort of like a nostalgia wink fest kind of thing. And I would sort of see that as exploiting nostalgia in a means to sort of profit.
I guess for me, it takes me right back to the 80s, for the obvious reasons, video nasties apart from anything else, but not just those, just that kind of era of films really kind of pushed the envelope, in a way that you don't get these days. So I kind of, because these days, there's an awful lot of people have gone back to those formative films for me. That's whole kind of area of horror films and whatever. I see it now, and you see it kind of being exploited in its own right, I guess, which is kind of fun.
The way I look at nostalgia exploitation is the studios and whatnot are exploiting your nostalgia. That they're not making a live-action Thundercats movie because this really needs to be made. They're exploiting the fact that you'll go, "Oh, wow, I remember the Thundercats."
Yeah.
It's exploiting your nostalgia. I'm not crapping on this series at all because it was a great series, but something like Stranger Things. Stranger Things, I'm not saying people didn't understand it, but people seem to take the wrong thing from the show. It was a very good show, and I'll get into one of the prongs of why it is not nostalgia exploitation later, but something like Strange Things, the impact it had was not, this is a really good 80s style TV show. It was, oh my God, look at all the 80s references, the 80s hair, the 80s. Look at how many lists came out on the internet after the season was released about all the 80s references you missed. And that wasn't the point. Stranger Things was not about, hey, look at all these 80s things. It was about, we're making a movie like a movie or a TV series like they did in the 80s. And I think that is kind of the disconnect that something like Stranger Things had with its own audience.
I really enjoyed Stranger Things as its own thing, making something in an 80s style rather than making something that is in an 80s style. Like they, I think they set out, much like the way, Refn makes a film where he just wants to make an 80s movie. Like Drive is like an 80s crime thriller, essentially. It's very 80s Michael Mann. And it doesn't feel like it's trying to cater to any nostalgia. It just wants to make that kind of a film. Whereas I feel like that's what Stranger Things was. It was trying to be very 80s Spielbergian kind of stuff. It sort of felt that way, but with more violence, obviously. Music as well. You had sort of it was a bit of a Vangelis, Tangerine Dream kind of tinge to the music. It didn't feel like it was trying to be super spoon-feed as far as like nostalgia exploiting goes. It felt more kind of like it was just trying to make something the way they did in the 80s. Like they're just unironically making it that way. Whereas you can very much spot something that is being ironic, like a Manborg or those kinds of films that are very much like, oh, look at, like in Kung Fury, it's like, oh, everybody wore Converse and headbands and knew karate and drove around in Lamborghinis, Ray-Bans. It's like, no, this is, the Kung Fury was entertaining and I loved a lot of the music in it, but that is the direct difference between something like Stranger Things, which is a very, very genuine attempt at making something that would have been made in the 80s. That feels like something that would have come out back then as a TV show or a film. Whereas Kung Fury just kind of seems like somebody, that one scene in Terminator with the tech noir, or saw a couple of like little 80s inspired posters or whatever with like neon pink and blue with leg warmers and people doing aerobics and shit, and just went, that's what the 80s was all the time. And it's like, no. No, it wasn't.
I got around to watching that, but I think Peter's right. There are certain films and products which are made, I guess, rather impersonal way to describe them as products, but there's various films, TV series, all that kind of stuff that can actually have been able to grab that 80s feel in a much more sincere way, in a way that doesn't feel like they're just trying to exploit it, I guess, is since we're on that subject. And there are other ones which are, you know, like, I guess Quentin Tarantino sometimes, or it just feels like he's flaunting that kind of look and feel on occasions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there is a balance to be found when it comes to that kind of stuff. And it's fun to have. It's fine to have a little bit of fun with that kind of sense that, yes, sometimes when you look back in the past at something like the 80s or the 70s or whatever, you can make a little bit of fun of them. I think, although it's not movie-based, something like Saints Row 4, when you have the 1950s sitcom section of that game, and then you got other things like...
In Saints Row 4, the part I like the most is when you can't even swear and your character points out the fact that you can't swear. Or in the Santa Claus expansion when it's all done like, you know, a 50s Norman Rockwell painting, but your character swearing and being violent is what sets everything off.
Yeah. And there's the Far Cry extra game, Blood Dragon Rules.
Yeah. That was great.
Got those wonderful sort of moments in those games that are just very much of the time that they're trying to portray, and they feel like it, they look like it.
Yeah, that one was very genuine. I mean, they even use music from Miami Connection before it's like Alamo Drafthouse re-release. They use music from like No Retreat, No Surrender, random soundtrack clips from like Rocky. Just stuff that you don't see getting regurgitated by everybody else. It felt like a real love letter to like 80s stuff, and you got Michael Biehn. It felt very much like a real Terminator knockoff from the 80s would. There's like American Warrior Steel Cyborg or whatever, like all these like weird cyborg cop and these types of movies.
Blood Dragon feels like it's the video game version of what a Charles Band Empire Picture Terminator ripoff would have been. again.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that's perfect. It's very, very Charles Bandy, for sure.
Yeah, it's a great sense of love with that as well, isn't there, really, when you see something like that? And I think with the example of Drive as well, there's a definite feeling of not trying to rip off that kind of aesthetic, but actually sort of buying into it. But then mm-hmm. you get another film which will come along and will try to do that, and it feels cheap.
Yeah.
That's when it really does kind of grind my gears, is when you get a movie that goes, yeah, I'm going to be the 80s. And I guess the Starsky and Hutch parody film, which is the only way I can describe it, that had a feeling of just going, pointing at a section of film history and TV history and just laughing at it and in a kind of sneery sort of way. And that's what I would call exploiting the 70s film kind of aesthetic. So you could call that a kind of exploitation in a way, I guess, but not in traditional sense.
It absolutely is. Because it absolutely is. Because you have the condescending look at nostalgia exploitation, which, like the Adam Sandler movies, Pixels and The Wedding Singer. The Wedding Singer was all about, oh my god, look at that 80s fashion. Wasn't that horrid? Oh my god, look at the music they listened to. Oh my, that whole movie was, look at the freak. Look at the 80s. And then you have something like Pixels. Pixels was all about just how many references can we shoehorn in here that don't really have anything to do with our plot. That's literally exploiting Q-Bert and Max Headroom and Pac-Man and all that, because people will go, oh, I know that. That's Q-Bert. That, to me, the Adam Sandler stuff is condescending nostalgia exploitation. Whereas, like, the RoboCop remake making fun of the original movie is more of an arrogant nostalgia exploitation. They want the name, but not what it was associated with.
Because they even show, like, the way the original RoboCop looked, and immediately Michael Keaton's character dismisses it, and it's like, no, it's got to be black and tactical, and red eyes would be more badass. Shut the f*** up. This is just horror. This is why your movie f***ing failed.
But you also have a weird kind of nostalgia exploitation that comes from a period piece that you're setting in the period for a specific reason, but for some reason the filmmakers decide to beat you over the head with the fact that it's a period piece. Like, I loved Kong Skull Island, but that movie was constantly reminding you, 1973, look at that music, look at the magazines, look at the hair, the music. I mean, that movie kept beating you over the head going, oh my god, 1973 is when this takes place. It's like, you know what? I was there for the first 20 minutes. I know it takes place in 1973. You beating me over the head with it does not help the movie.
No, but that's an awful lot like whenever you see a film with London in, for instance, you've always got Big Ben and some pompous British anthem going on, or if you go
to Big Ben Parliament,
you go to China and you'll get or something like that, you know?
Or Canada, even, like, they always have to make it obvious that it's Canada. Everything's cold, everyone loves maple syrup, everyone's wearing flannel. It's very, very much everyone loves hockey. Like, I f***ing hate hockey.
For America, I'll say sorry.
Yay.
Sorry, eh?
Sorry, the condescending nostalgia exploitation. Okay, this isn't so condescending, but like Yoga Hosers. Now, Kevin Smith seemed very earnest. I mean, Yoga Hosers was a god-awful movie, but he seemed kind of earnest in the movie he was making. Where I think he's being condescending is that he says he made this movie for teenage girls. Okay, fine, because teenage girls are going to get those references to 80s Anthrax songs and 60s Batman and He-Man and things like that, right? No, you made this for you.
Some of them will, but not all of them. It seems more like he's trying to pass the buck on it not doing so well, like, because it was kind of panned, wasn't it? Like, I don't think a lot of people
I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's a god-awful movie.
I haven't seen it yet. I watched Tusk. And it really pissed me off. And then this sort of looks like it's in the same vein. So
It is. Johnny Depp plays the same character he did in Tusk in this.
Oh, dear God. Screw
yeah,
that.
It's a sequel.
No, I'll be skipping that one. But it does seem like he's made all these references that people more of his generation would have gotten, or even people of mine, that around roughly, you know, mid-20s, early 30s, later 30s, mid-40s kind of thing. Whereas now he's saying, oh, you know, it's for millennial teenage girls. And it's like, you're trying to pass the buck now because it's a stupid movie, and now you're just saying, oh, well, it's directed to teenagers. Come on, Kevin.
I think when it comes to how you relate to your audience, obviously there's going to be very different ways that you relate to your audience when it comes to historical kind of times. And if you're trying to communicate something like the 70s, the 80s, 60s, 50s, whatever time, you know, which is before a large part of your audience would have been alive or possibly just aware of, you do have to have a certain amount of what to us would be condescension. And that sounds a little bit sort of crappy, but I mean, when you're talking about a film which is an hour and a half, 2 hours long, you've got limited time to actually kind of communicate certain stuff. And it's fine if you're making a film about the 70s that is for an audience that remembers the 70s. But if you've got an audience that was born in the 90s or the 2000s, then there's a certain amount of scene setting, I guess, you got to do. Would that seem fair?
Very few old properties are brought to a new audience in a serious way. Like, Glenn, you brought up the Starsky and Hutch movie, which kicked off. Mm-hmm. Like, right now, we've got Baywatch coming. It's a parody of the original Baywatch. We've got Chips coming.
Of course it is.
It's a parody of the original. And you have so many of these. I mean, you had Bewitched. And I can't even list all of the movies that decided we're going to make fun of the originals. The original Starsky and Hutch and Chips and Baywatch and that were not great. They have an arrogant condescension of, oh my god, these were so bad. Like the 21 Jump Street movies. Even though they're technically not a reboot because they're in the same continuity, they're technically a sequel. Both those movies are all about, oh my god, can you believe how stupid 21 Jump Street the show was?
Mm.
And I hate that point of condescension that they come from of making fun of it. I mean, after Starsky and Hutch, the next movie they were going to do was a Cagney and Lacey movie in the same vein, where Cagney and Lacey were man-hating dykes because they were strong, powerful women in the 1982 show. So that means today they're dykes, right?
Wow. That's... Jesus.
Yeah, that does annoy me. That kind of attitude is, I mean, that's not just showing a lack of respect for the period that it's set in. It's certainly, showing a lack of respect for the idea. And that's one of the worst things. I mean, it's fine to look back and have a few knowing nods of, yeah, that was a bit dated and that was a bit silly. Basing your entire movie's premise on that kind of attitude is, it's a joke that wears thin very, very quickly, I think. And not only that, it shows a absolute lack of respect for anybody who did grow up with that stuff and liked that stuff. It's very easy to look back and just go, oh my God, that stuff was all lame. That is the worst kind of sort of youth mentality, I think, is, oh my God, it's in black and white. I didn't like that because it's in black and white. You know, that's...
There was one property that I think did it right, and that was the 1987 Dragnet. When Dan Aykroyd brought that into the 80s, and that was an official sequel to Dragnet, so that is not a reboot, is he said, we're both going to make fun of not the old TV show and radio program, but how they don't work in an 80s cop show setting. And that's what was perfect about Dragnet. You had his character and Tom Hanks' character as each of the archetypes, and the movie showed how they don't really work together and how they have to work to make each, you know, to massage each other to work. And I think that's why Dragnet was such a successful film, maybe not box office wise, but as a continuation property, it showed respect to the original while pointing out, yeah, it wasn't perfect.
I think a good example to something like that would be something like Return of the Living Dead, which is almost sort of the same thing, where it's connected in a way to the original Night of the Living Dead, but kind of saying, like, you know, it's Night of the Living Dead exists as a film within Return of the Living Dead, but it's all, this is something that really happened. So it's kind of paying respects to the original by also making something that's satirical, but very much serious and cool in its own way.
There's a lot of films that try to do that kind of thing, though. My mind always comes to stuff like Club Dread or Tucker and Dale versus Evil, as films that actually kind of do that stuff and work. I mean, you don't have to necessarily like the films. I know you don't like Club Dread, but it's one of those films that takes the object of its derision and actually shows an awful lot of love for that. It plays all the tropes and stuff, but it doesn't just go, that's stupid, that's stupid, that's stupid. There's a clear love for the subject matter in there, which films like the Starsky and Hutch and films of its kind don't seem to quite manage to do. They just look at it and go, it's stupid, it's stupid, it's stupid, and it feels like they've barely watched the things as well. It feels like they've read some sort of list from a particular kind of websites that you see these days that just look at something and point out the flaws rather than actually going, yeah, they're flaws, but we love them. You know, I think Dragnet was another one, as far as I can remember of it, was another one that actually does that kind of stuff well, that not only pokes fun at it, but is clearly done by someone who had an affection for the subject matter.
But then you've got the other side of the token, where some humor and lightness for the original is necessary, like the Michael Mann Miami Vice movie. That was so dark and serious and utterly humorless. If it wasn't for the names of the characters, it's got nothing to do with Miami Vice. That's yeah. One where I think they needed a little bit more color and levity. He overcorrected, I think, from Starsky and Hutch.
I really hate the Miami Vice movie. I was looking forward to seeing it when it came out, and it was such a boring, bland, flat film. I love Miami Vice, at least the first couple seasons of it. It's a really, really great staple of 80s television, and was very cool when it came to, like, you know, sleazy crime drama, undercover cop kind of stuff. And I really love it for that. I love it for all the music in it. And then the movie was just such a departure from that. And I could see people enjoying it if they weren't really a fan of the original, like a weird GoPro kind of look to it, like using very cheap looking digital cameras. It was a strange departure from Michael Mann. His movies always felt so much more grand scale in all his other projects, you know, films like Heat and films like Manhunter and Thief, which have such a great large scale look to them, with a lot of at least his 80s films would use a lot of color, some neon and very like driving kind of like da 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 da, like 80s kind of synthy music. And anytime he would use like Tangerine Dream or something like that. Him to me is, he was one of those like prototypical like 80s filmmakers that really captured the aesthetic that I really enjoyed probably the most. And then his Miami Vice feature finally that he made in the 2000s with, you know, Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx, too much of a departure from the original source material that I just wasn't able to enjoy it. Like all of the things that made Miami Vice interesting weren't in it.
It's another one of those times where they've actually got thing that they captured slightly the other way around with that particular example, I guess. Certainly they tried to go for some of the look, and perhaps didn't capture, some of the feel of what's going on. And that's something that happens quite often when they're trying to do something retro, is they'll get the look, but they won't get the feel of the originals. And in some respects, you're kind of wondering what it is they're thinking when they're doing this. That is it just an aesthetic thing that they're looking at? In which case, why bother? Why not just make it, you know, absolutely current? Go that way with the same story, you know, just shift it in time and do it, rather than even trying to approach it as being a period piece, I guess.
Which is exactly one of the other things. When you're doing a nostalgia exploitation, the biggest prong that you have to hit, and this is what I think Stranger Things both fails and absolutely succeeds, is if you take the setting out, and if you, like Stranger Things, if it was not set in 1983 and was set in 1993 or 2013 or any other time, would the story still work? And I think for Stranger Things, to a degree, yes it would, and to a degree, no it wouldn't. Something like The Wedding Singer, take that out of the 80s, it's the exact same story. The 80s are just there to go, ha ha, look at the 80s. That's when you know you're exploiting the nostalgia. When you have the wrong audience. Okay, I'm going to correct myself. Not the wrong audience, because I wasn't born until 1975, and I grew up watching 1950s monster movies and 30s Universal films and all that. So, you know, older people might have said, well, I'm the wrong audience for that. So, no, I misspoke there.
Ah.
When you're aiming at the wrong audience, I'll change it to that. Because it was recently revealed in a study that of like, you know, all the 80s nostalgia that's coming out with all the t-shirts and all the posters, and they're, you know, putting out all these 80s DVDs, you know, I mean, 80s movies on DVD at Walmart. You can get like a classic 80s set, 8 movies for $10. And it's got, you know, Legend of Billie Jean, Weird Science and all that on it. A recent study found that over 70% of the stuff from the 80s is being consumed by people that weren't born until the 90s.
Wow.
So is it a strange thing that the people consuming this are getting, I don't want to say skewed, but their version of an 80s movie is what they're being sold versus what it actually was?
Kind of. I mean, you did make the example that you enjoyed stuff from like 80s and 60s when, you know, you were growing up in the 70s and the 80s. So it could just be that yearning to kind of find out more about that era and having an interest in it. Cause I know I was born in 88. And when I was growing up, you know, in the early to mid 90s, I was watching a shit ton of 80s movies and 70s movies, 60s movies. I loved all the Universal monster stuff and Hammer horror and, you know, 80s slashers and 80s cyberpunk sci-fi action flicks and whatnot. So it could just be whatever you're into, you're into. If you see something, you latch onto it, you enjoy it, great. Have fun with it. But I do think a lot, I'm going to say more of the bigger studio stuff that's trying to capitalize and exploit the 80s, they're the ones skewing people's perception. It's not so much the younger people that are watching the real 80s movies like Weird Science and stuff. They're actually watching genuine stuff. Bigger studios that are putting out, and I've saw an ad for this particular film on YouTube just the other day. It's called Baby Driver. I don't know if either of you have seen a trailer for this one yet.
I have missed all the advertising for that one.
It is an obvious weird cash in on the whole 80s retro wave kind of boom. It's a very 80s, I would say 80s exploitation. I wouldn't even say 80s style, because the main character, he's wearing a Letterman jacket. He's wearing Ray-Ban sunglasses. He's a getaway driver for a sleazy, you know, criminal cartel or whatever. He falls in love with this unassuming waitress who calls him baby. Everybody calls him baby. He's this mysterious guy. There's of course like sort of synthy music in the trailer, and there's little nods to 80s things. Like they're gonna rob a bank, and a guy is wearing a Austin Powers mask, and then the guy tells him, I told you to get a Michael Myers mask. I am wearing Mike Myers. But no, that's Austin Powers. Yeah, Austin Powers was Mike Myers, dude, the killer from Halloween. Oh, you mean Jason. And it's this like very, it's horrible. Like I saw the trailer and the first thing that clicked to me, this is 6 years too late to try to piggyback off of Nick Reffin's Drive.
What it sounds like is this is made by someone who did not grow up with those things first run.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's what I'm getting from it. It's a very like studio boardroom kind of thing. It's like, you know, I've really been noticing a lot online and show. There's the Stranger Things and Kung Fury and all this stuff. Turbo Kid did good. There was that Drive movie, and there's all these like YouTube channels with like retro wave music and stuff. He make a movie like that. So let's go down the list. You got Letterman jackets, dark sunglasses that you wear indoors and at nighttime, the synthy music, slasher joke stuff. Let's make that into a movie. And it just feels so fucking studio, like a big studio idiot movie of none of these people are actually fans of this kind of stuff or grew up with any of it. It's just a studio full of moron talking heads that think they know their audience better than the audience know themselves. And it just seems like what I'm perceiving it to be, which is if Drive was left in the hands of big studio execs.
It's kind of popular for whatever reason. I guess, you know, you're always kind of, there is a tendency for people to look back at certain periods of time and pick out the goofier stuff really to kind of look at. I mean, I could do that with a photo album really when I look back at me in the 70s, for instance. My God, the collars.
You wore bell bottoms, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, but yeah, I think that's as much to do with the people that are kind of making it. And it's not to say that they're people who haven't actually lived through it, because I pretty much guarantee most people who are kind of in that position to green light or even control or manipulate those products, they are going to be about our sort of age. When you look back at, you know, when you look back at some of the stuff that we kind of watched, there's certain things that played with those kind of nostalgia sort of things, or even played up the images of the time. I mean, if you look at Gremlins, how many kind of culture references does something like Gremlins make.
I would say Gremlins 2 has even more.
But, oh, God.
Well yeah, I actually like Gremlins 2 more than the first film, and I told that to Joe Dante. God. He agreed with me.
What was what even confused me as a kid was when it kind of snaps back from being a movie to being a movie within a movie, and you have Hulk Hogan watching the film and telling the Gremlins to shut up, and it's like, what the hell is going on?
But, I mean, the first one is filled with references. I mean, it's more of a, I guess, a 1950s kind of film. When you look at a lot of stuff that's going on in there, it's almost like a really perverse version of It's a Wonderful Life. You know, you got this kind of small town America in at Christmas, and you've got your Grinchy character in the old lady, and you've got
he's a bank teller.
Yeah, you got the kind-hearted person who's, you know, an outrageous drunk, and there's even images the bar where the gremlin's got the leg warmers and all that kind of stuff. So they're even poking fun at the time they're in.
Well, yeah, but Glenn, that's kind of
it's a wonderful It's a Wonderful Life did not have Dick Miller, so Gremlins wins.
And that's fair enough. I think they actually play clips from A Wonderful Life in Gremlins as well. I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly, but I feel like somewhere on a TV it was playing.
I think you're right, and I think it was actually a big
They probably did. But I mean, Weird Science is sort of the same way. It's not only so obviously inspired by Bride of Frankenstein specifically, they're actually watching it on TV at one point.
Yeah, it was kind of meant to be like a modern take on Frankenstein's monster. It's like, what if instead of with lightning and with dead body parts and stuff, what if we with a computer? So that's sort of the 80s variation of that kind of tale.
Yeah. But see, I don't consider that exploiting Bride of Frankenstein, because they're doing like an update without it really being an update. But like
more of a nod. Like it's more of kind of a respectful nod, I would say.
Right. And I'm not saying that, oh, the movies I like are okay when they do this. I'm saying, look at what the movie is doing. Who is asking for some of these movies? Like Chips and Baywatch being the newest ones. Who was clamoring for a Chips movie after all these years?
I remember that being very, very camp, even when it was out and even in the day.
Feels like there's no point in making like a campy reboot of it when it was already like, has anybody seen that film? Does anybody remember the TV show and how hammy Eric Estrada was and shit? Like, I mean, do we really need a movie that pokes fun at it when it clearly kind of already was pretty satirical because I've seen, you know, reruns of it and whatnot. It was a pretty like, it played the line of being kind of funny and really poking fun at itself and being sort of campy and whatnot. So I don't see the point.
I just want to know who's going to play Quincy in the Quincy movie.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm desperately trying to think of some names, but yes, it's very early in the morning. My brain is just...
Then what about when they are doing this nostalgia exploitation, like Miami Vice and Chips and Baywatch and stuff like that, and the main audience that's going to go see these, because like a movie like the Chips movie and the Baywatch movie, those are made for people who did not watch Chips and Baywatch growing up. These movies are not made for your built-in audience. They're made for the people who aren't your built-in audience. Is that a flawed perspective to come from right off the bat?
I don't think it's the best way to approach any particular reboot, I guess you could call it, revival. I think that allows him to do an awful lot of other things, but I think for anybody who is a fan of those properties, those titles, they're always going to be a little bit shortchanged by that because it's just a recycling project at that point for those people, and that's a real letdown for anybody who's actually familiar with the history that's going on. And you'll notice that they always put in the little things, the little tropes from whatever thing that they're doing, so they can say, yeah, well, you know, you can see in the original there's this, and then in the remake we've gone and we've upped it by 10 times and that sort of thing. And I don't even know why they bother, to be quite honest with you, why they don't just slap a new name on it and make it a new property completely. I don't know any fans of the original who would enjoy that kind of approach, you know, when all you're doing is mercilessly mocking it. I mean, we all know as fans the shortcomings of any particular thing from our childhood or from our younger years. What they're trying to say, what they're trying to do, are they pointing fun at us as well and saying you were stupid for liking that stuff? Or it never feels loving. It always feels a bit cynical and a bit lazy.
Yeah, even when it's kind of the opposite too. Like, you know, the way what they're doing with Chips, it's like they're trying to make it even more goofy and even more silly. Then you have the other spectrum, which is taking something that was very hammy and whatnot as a property, you know, when you were younger. Like for me, it was Power Rangers. That's kind of what was really big at the time when I was growing up. And it was, you know, shiny motorcycle helmet wearing dudes that fought monsters and their big cardboard robot. And then you've got the new, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers will be coming out, and it looks like super dark, and their outfits look like, colorful versions of, you know, Christopher Nolan's Batman outfit. They're trying to make the monsters scarier. They're trying to make the, color in the show a lot more. So it's kind of the opposite. It's like, remember this like really campy, fun-loving thing you liked as a kid? It's like, now it's all dark and gruesome for the modern age. I don't know how to feel about that. I don't know if it's trying to be nice narration, or that shit was wicked when you were a kid. Now it's fucking turbocharged. It seemed to have the same level of heart. It feels very like shiny, and it's trying to be bleak and dark, and it's like it was the kids version when you were a kid. Now you've grown up. Now you've got the version for adults, and it's like I can still enjoy cartoons and stuff when I was growing up. You know, I can still enjoy stuff like the old X-Men cartoon and the 90s Batman. Hell, I can still sit down and watch some episodes of Power Rangers and enjoy them. I don't need to have the saturation turned down and the darkness and shadows added in to remind me that I'm watching something adult. Don't try to spoon feed this kind of shit to me.
Yeah, I think it's a shame when something's presented to a younger audience and there is no frame of reference for them. I think for the audience, maybe it's possibly for the better, because if having to make that comparison can sometimes be a deal breaker for any revived product, I guess. I think, you know, certainly with something like Chips, I don't even know how that would actually read again. Because, I mean, when it came to stuff like The A-Team, for instance, like that, I can't watch those anymore. I daren't watch them anymore. Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, I most of that I daren't go back and watch again, because I do have very fond memories of it. Certain things I can go back to because I already remembered them for what they were. But as a kid watching the A-Team, you know, I couldn't see any of the faults at the time. I just enjoyed them in a very, I guess, passive kind of way. As we do with a lot of stuff when you're kids.
Don't you love it when a plan comes together?
Yes. When they did the remake of it, that's a bad film. That's a bad remake in just about every possible way.
I'll give it one thing. Liam Neeson was damn perfect as Hannibal, though.
Yeah. And probably a lot nicer to work with. But you kind of look at those, that kind of thing, and the film somehow managed to really kind of pump up the stupid as well, which was astounding. But I think as an audience member, if you hadn't seen the originals and you watched that, you might have found it quite passable. But as a as somebody who was familiar with it, watching it, that was a weird experience seeing that film.
What's almost weird about the A-Team remake as well is, at least whenever I'd watch the original show on reruns and stuff, my favorite character was always Mr. T. To me, it was like, it's about Mr. T. It's about Mr. T's van. That's the whole point of the show. He's the coolest character. He's Mr. T. Shut up.
He wasn't even B.A. Baracus to you? Was he just Mr. T?
It's just Mr. T. It's just Mr. T shows up, kicks everybody's ass, and he rides around in his cool van. And then the original, not the original, but the remake, they made it all about Face Man. Played by Bradley Cooper, and it's all about him doing sit-ups and shit like that. It's like, I don't give a fuck about Face. I don't like this character. He was boring in the original show. Nobody paid it. It was all about, like, Hannibal and Mr. T and the wild card character. What's his face?
Murdoch.
Yeah, those three were the best, and Face was always boring. Like, nobody, he was just like, okay, we're gonna send you into the building to like charm up the woman at the desk, and then we're gonna sneak in and go beat up everybody, and then plan comes together, blah blah blah, Mr. T punches somebody, end of the episode. Whereas like the remake is like, oh, Bradley Cooper is so hot, and it's like, who the hell cares? This was the most boring character in the original show. Like, features the van. Like, it was such a weird version of something that was so entertaining for certain reasons, and they took all of those things that made like the original endearing and were like, let's make it about this character that nobody gave a shit about. That's a good idea.
Are sequels decades after the fact nostalgia exploitation, like Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights, or the Wall Street sequel and all that? Is that nostalgia exploitation where they're like, you loved this movie in the 80s, now we're finally making the sequel we should have made a year after the original? Is that nostalgia exploitation or just exploitation?
Oh man, cause I have differentiating opinions when it comes to that, cause some of them are, I good. Like, I very much enjoyed, I forget which year it was. They both came out like a year after one another. It was the first Rocky Balboa and then Rambo, like Rambo 4 and Rocky 6, I guess you would call it. I liked those a lot. I thought Stallone did a really good job with those, and they felt like the right bookend that those should have gotten, because Rambo 3 should be retitled to Rambo Helps the Al-Qaeda, which is very cringy. And then you have Rocky 5, which ends on such a weird down note of, like, you know, he's lost everything. He has none of his fame left. He's broke. He has a street fight with some random failed boxer at the end of the movie, and he headbutts a Don King wannabe. I think that's how it ended. So it was a very weird way to end the series. So I feel like Rocky Balboa was nice.
When it's done, I think it's a good thing to do it in a fashion that moves with the times to some extent. Certainly when you're talking about Rambo and things like that, that's a very good example. But you do get plenty of films that come along, you know, and again, we're just going to revive that, and it's pretty much more of the same. And I guess with the example of Rambo 2 and 3 were very much that. They were very much emptier vessels. They were done to kind of just push that story back out there. Whereas the first and the last one were very much more stories that furthered the characters and all that kind of stuff. Like kind of sequels that do come years after the fact. Usually take those characters and kind of put them in a different context. And with the Wall Street, for instance, I think having such a massive gap and having the change in where the characters are and what they are is an interesting thing to do. It's arguable about how well they actually managed to do it in that one, but I certainly applaud the attempt to not just capitalize on the original, but to kind of go, right, this is where they were in the 80s and this is where they are now. That's an interesting kind of approach to take. Whether it, like I say, whether or not it succeeds or not is another matter.
I'm just waiting for the gritty Alf reboot where, because he liked to eat cats, they substituted for grabbing pussy in the Trump era.
Oh,
and they try to make some political allegory out of Alf, and, you know, like he's literally an illegal alien or something. I could see.
I just picture Alf saying, oh, grab him by the pussy. And it's like little Alf voice.
But then I guess then the last one would be, is it nostalgia exploitation when you make a movie out of a show? And in this case, it's a show I absolutely loved, and I liked the movie too, but of a show no one really remembers. Remember when they made Naked Gun? That was a movie version sequel of a TV show that bombed and was almost completely forgotten. It's amazing that the Naked Gun movie got made, but I can't imagine what the thought process was. Remember that TV show that lasted 6 episodes and came in almost dead last? Why don't we make a movie out of that and then have a studio throw money at them? That's something that should be championed, huh? The fact that Police Squad was made into successful movies is kind of a minor miracle.
Yeah, and I didn't even know that Police Squad was a show until I think you pointed it out, and I binge watched.
I actually think the show is better. I watched
it's
the
hilarious.
6 episodes of the TV show again. It's actually funnier than the damn movie.
It's so unforgivably, or not unforgivably, but what is it, like, it's just completely unapologetically politically incorrect. Like, there's a scene, I forget what episode it is, but like, it's these characters are at a party and the girl is like, oh, let's go out and talk in the Asian garden, and they go outside, Asian people standing in garden pots. Like, for no fucking reason. They're just, that's it. It's an actual literal Asian garden. And that made
The pun is funny.
I had to pause it because I was laughing so hard at how fucking taken aback by that I was. Like, I wasn't expecting that. I thought they were just going to go out and there were going to be, like, little bonsai trees or whatever. But no, it's just it's an Asian businessman, an Asian businesswoman, and a little Asian kid. And they're standing in, like, garden pots. And it's like, I about died laughing just because it was so random.
Joe Dante directed 2 episodes of those 6, too.
Oh, I could see that. I could really see that. It's his style of
style all the
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely, yes.
it's a nice thing when it can be one of the few positive things when studios revisit old properties is when they bring attention to the originals. Even with the bad film versions, at the very least, they do introduce the originals to some extent, or at least the idea of the original to the to a new audience. And if we're going to come away with anything, I guess, positive from nostalgia exploitation, I guess that's possibly it. And even with someone like Quentin Tarantino, the references that he makes has probably brought many people to films that they would otherwise never have got the chance to see or even hear about.
At least with Tarantino, he actually includes people like Sid Haig and Robert Forster and the people from the era, and he revives their careers.
Yeah, even like
something like Chips and Baywatch, I don't even know if there's cameos from the original crew or from the original cast. Mm. You know, it's all new. Tarantino at least has reverence for, you know what? Robert Forster made a lot of kick-ass 80s movies.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring him into this because Jackie Brown is one of those weird examples where it is nostalgia exploitation, but it's done right. The movie is definitely a late 90s movie, but it almost perfectly feels like a mid-70s crime thriller.
Mm-hmm. It feels
and that
very,
is
very
hard serious. To do.
Yeah, and that's where the love comes in. I mean, as much as Quentin Tarantino has an awful lot of faults, I don't think there's any legitimacy in denying the fact that he loves that stuff. That certainly comes through in the films that he makes, that he has this near obsessive love with those
things.
He's
the only person who would have put Sonny Chiba in a mainstream studio film in this day and age.
Yeah, he loves everything about that stuff, and that's very apparent. And he's introduced a lot of people to many films and many character actors and so on that they may never have had the opportunity to have seen otherwise. I think as nostalgia exploitation goes, for whatever his faults, we kind of owe him a little bit of credit for at least that.
But you also have something like The Expendables. The Expendables movies,
I like the
are nostalgia exploitation.
I enjoyed the second one. I'm not big on the first and third one.
Okay, well, The Expendables movies to me are pure nostalgia exploitation. To me, if you had a totally different cast of all modern actors, it wouldn't work at all. It fails the prong of, if you take out the nostalgia factor, does the movie still work?
No.
Like with Stranger Things. You take out the nostalgia factor, it still works. Mm-hmm. Expendables, you take out the nostalgia factor, it's just a really expensive direct-to-video movie.
Yeah, very.
That's kind of the point, though, because it was meant to be this sort of celebration of all the old action stars coming together and just having fun. I like it. I didn't hate the first one. I enjoyed it, and I felt like it needed more over-the-top oomph to it.
Needed more Eric Roberts, damn it.
Yeah, of course. he did get a cool death, though. He gets shot like 6 times and has a giant knife thrown through him. That was pretty cool. But then the second one, I feel like, upped the ante. There was more over-the-top kind of stuff, which is what I wanted to see. The first one felt...
Jean-Claude Van Damme was playing a character named Villain.
Yes. See, it's very self-aware. They knew exactly what they were doing. They just wanted to have fun and make a movie that is, I think, pretty much tailored for people who grew up with and love 80s and early 90s action films, specifically a lot of the direct-to-video stuff. It feels like more of a very good direct-to-video kind of action film rather than like an actual studio theater one, and I really liked it. I think Expendables 2 is incredibly fun, and all the little cameos and people getting together and having fun and stuff and just kicking ass with loads of violence, and the fist fight between Van Damme and Stallone is just great. And then the third one decided to go with the PG-13 rating, converted to the producer's or director's cut, which in that effect, it was something very cheap they're doing. They'll film a movie bloodless, and then in the afterwards, they will edit in the CG blood, and so they could be like, oh, R-rated director's cut. And it's like, no, it isn't. This is the same exact movie. You're maybe adding in a couple more fucks here and there and a couple more little fake blood splatters. The Expendables 3 was very, very much a letdown. How much of a departure from the fun of the second and kind of the first one were.
You have stuff like that or like Scream. Scream is one of those condescending, oh my my God, all those slasher movies you guys loved, here's why they all suck. Scream had a smugness to it that literally pissed me off when I was watching it.
I found the first one or two were fine. It was later on. I certainly didn't get that feel from, particularly the first one. I thought Wes Craven pretty much hit an awful lot of that stuff pretty well. And that's a guy that not only grew up with that stuff, he was making that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like it's not like the 80s slasher movies are above criticism. It was the smug, arrogant script that really sunk that movie for me. It wasn't necessarily the direction or the actors. The script was so smug and self-assured, and I've used this word a bunch of times, but condescending to the audience.
I never got that myself. I think possibly the, I can't remember who was the actor played the killer in it.
Skeet Ulrich and Matthew Lillard.
Yeah, Skeet. I think there was a certain, I don't know, maybe there was a little bit of a miscasting in them.
Because Skeet Ulrich is just discount Johnny Depp.
He is, isn't he?
That's a pretty good observation. I think it was just the way a lot of the lines were delivered, and particularly the killer's voice in the phone calls and stuff did feel incredibly scripted. That's the only real kind of complaint I would have with that particular movie is that aspect of it, and I can see that would particularly perhaps suggest a certain arrogance to it, because that's how that character was played, deliberately or otherwise. I don't know, but you know, I thought it was all right. I thought it was okay, and I think it kind of, particularly because it came from someone like Wes Craven, someone who has made his career out of doing that stuff. I'm more inclined to give it a little bit of trust, I guess, that was never the intent, and it didn't really come across quite like that to me. Maybe just being a little bit cynical.
Nostalgia exploitation is heading in a dangerous direction, I think. You have something like Kung Fury. It is played on El Rey and, you know, massive social media presence. And it didn't work for me because it was all making fun of the 80s. You have a film like Turbo Kid, which is the film Kung Fury should have been.
Yes.
And Turbo Kid is almost completely unknown.
Turbo Kid is fantastic.
That's the problem. Turbo Kid was freaking great. And Turbo Kid subverted my expectations, because within the first 5 minutes, I thought I was going to hate Apple. I thought, oh God, we're going to have to spend the whole movie with her. She's the damn heart of that movie. That movie doesn't work without Apple. Turbo Kid is the movie Kung Fury wanted to be. That's where I think we're going in a dangerous direction with Chips and Baywatch and all this. We are literally exploiting nostalgia instead of using it as a springboard for something else.
Or embracing it genuinely.
Embracing is the perfect word.
Because that's what Turbo Kid did. It felt very much like a love letter to that kind of stuff. And a lot of times it even felt like a
without
genuine,
being smug about it.
Yeah.
It was not smug.
It honestly felt like it would have come out in the 80s. Like it had a lot of, what it reminded me the most of, I think it was Enzo Castellari's Warriors of the Wasteland is sort of what it reminded me of. Ended me of, because it just vibe of like cheap Italian Mad Max cyber kind of knockoff, where it's like there's no more gasoline in the world, so everybody has to ride bicycles, and they're kind of like filming around their budget, like kind of saying.
And
like,
Michael
okay,
Ironside is a villain. Come on.
Yeah, he's fantastic at it. He's really, really, really good, and all the costumes look like they were kind of thrown together. Then it really felt like something you would randomly discover from the archives of like random Italian Mad Max exploitation type movies. It really felt genuine to that kind of era, and the music was fantastic. I loved everybody, I think, gave a great performance, including the Apple and that weird, like, random robot hand Australian dude and Michael Ironside and that villain who's in, like, he's wearing, like, the skull mask and kind of looks like Casey Jones and shit. Like, it's just everybody in that movie was great. And the costumes really had that, like, kind of Mad Max exploitation look to it. Like as I said, like, you know, Warriors of the Wasteland and Endgame and 2019 After the Fall of New York. Like, Kung Fury was very tongue-in-cheek. And I think it was going in that direction. And I'm glad its duration was only about 30 minutes, because I think if that went to feature length, I might have hated it. But I think the shorter length made it work. And it had, even you shared one of the tracks from the film. You have to admit, at least the music in Kung Fury is pretty f***ing great.
I hope that there will be enough films still continue to come out that actually celebrate the history of film and television as opposed to just strip mining it. And that's when it's demonstrably the worst stuff, when you get the Starsky and Hutches, when you get those terrible semi-comedy, in air quotes, kind of products that come out, is when the studios basically are looking at the negative aspects of the original rather than demonstrating a love for them. And whether you go with a film that is a comedic take or whether it's a serious take, there has to be that recognition of the inspiration and why it's an inspiration. Whether it's an inspiration for it to be an object of having a few laughs and enjoying it for those things, or whether it's, or whether you're looking at it and going, actually, there were good serious things, and then going in that direction. That's where I hope it goes. But we're talking about Hollywood and the likes here. We all know there's going to be plenty of the versions that are just basically, look at all the silly shit that went on in that. Isn't it stupid? And that's a shitty attitude, in my opinion.
And we didn't even get to, because, I mean, Tarantino doesn't set all of his movies in the 70s. We didn't even get to something like Rob Zombie. We get it. You love the 1970s, Rob. So, on that note, where can we find Pete Dergagic?
You can find me on Twitter at Cinematica, on Facebook, Cinemasochist, on YouTube, The Cinemasochist, and on 1201beyond.com, clutching to my nostalgia like a f***ing security blanket.
Where can we find Glenn Criddle from the future?
It's hard to get nostalgic about the future, isn't it? You can find me on YouTube as LampyMan101. I also write for Frankly Green Bay. And just Google the Nasties review. You'll find probably many, many re-uploads of people wanting to take my views.
Sounds a little bitter, but okay. And you can find me at 1201beyond.com. And you go to the website, it's very an 80s looking website. I like the 80s, my favorite decade. You go to 1201beyond.com, you can contact this show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. Guys, try to be a cut above, keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold. Have a good night.
some action!
Radiodrome is a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.